This is Icon Art Radio with Alan Cobb, Donna Colby, and me, Bill Teeple. Well, you have some material that you've gleaned from one of my favorite guys, Joseph Campbell.
Yes, I have actually owned a first edition set of his four book series, Primitive Mythology, Oriental, Occidental, and Creative Mythology, for years, and I have never actually read them. I've read other Joseph Campbell books, but that set, beautiful set, has been sitting in my bookshelf. And the other day, for some reason, I just got the impulse to start with the first volume, which was called Primitive Mythology. And already in the introduction, I was just thrilled. And so I just thought, you know, one of the ideas that was brought up in the introduction I would throw out and we could talk about it because it was very directly related to art. He was talking about play and the different ways that cultures in the past or even some cultures today relate to play, as opposed to our Western culture that doesn't really think play is that appropriate for grown-ups unless it's, you know, playing football or some approved method like that. And he told this one interesting story, which I loved. He was talking about in aristocratic Japan, there was actually a convention of language where the attitude of play was built into any sentence you would say to these aristocratic people. Like, for example, instead of saying, "I see you have arrived in Tokyo," you would say, "I see that you are playing at arriving in Tokyo." And even if somebody died, instead of saying, "I hear that your father is dead," you would say, "I hear that your father has played dying." And Joseph Campbell went on to say, "Nobility of spirit is the grace or ability to play, rather than to be seized by the weighty issues of life." And to the Greeks, this was considered a virtue that they attributed to artists, poets, and philosophers, that they felt was a crucial element of being an artist, poet, or philosopher. Where there was no objective reality, it was understood by, you know, anybody who was behaving that way that everything was illusory and that we were playing at it willingly as participants. And that seeing this way and participating this way would keep people from getting gripped by either a firm belief in some fixed, unchanging relative reality, or hopelessness, a desire to escape from life. So anyway, I thought this would be a good thing to throw around, especially in how it relates to artists, because in many cultures, artists are considered the people who don't grow up. And they're often looked down upon for that. But in this context of what he was pointing out about that ability to play, it's seen in a different light as some valuable thing.
It's a subject near and dear to my heart. Well, Joseph Campbell in particular, because when I was in college, he came to visit our campus, and I was his host. Wow. So I spent about 5 days with him most of the time he was there, and I sat in on all the discussions and things. And there was one elite group of professors and students who spent a couple of long afternoons with him talking about things, and we had a fairly well-known African scholar on staff or on the faculty who specialized in Swahili mythology. And he decided to ask Joseph Campbell a question about this particular myth and this particular branch of, you know, a particular tribal system. It was very specialized information. And of course, he'd been translating the Swahili himself because he was a serious anthropologist. And he finished asking the question, and Joseph Campbell sat there. And I had been struck by Joseph Campbell's appearance when he arrived. He looked, I hate to say it, but he looked sort of dumpy. He looked like a guy with, you know, that you just walk by without even noticing, or who might be selling meat in a butcher store or something. And he had sort of heavy features, and he was sort of dark and wore a black suit and stuff. But he was very lively, and he listened patiently to this question, and it was obvious that the professor was trying to start on a high level and show he had pretty deep knowledge in this area. Joseph Campbell said, well, some of what you just quoted sounds a little unusual, because the French scholar so-and-so translated that passage as, and then he recited it in French. And he said, actually, the Swahili should have been, and then he spoke a few lines in Swahili. And then he said, but this is all from a dialect of Swahili that's not from that region. That translation is bogus. And the German scholar so-and-so translated this other myth, which has a long passage in it, which curiously enough is in the Swahili of the region you're referring to, and is probably the original language that has just been taken out of context and patched into this other piece of mythological verse. And so he quoted some of the German, and then he quoted the other Swahili and pointed out some of the distinctions between them. And our professor, you know, was lying on the floor, gasping for breath at that point. And Joseph Campbell just went right on and tied it into other things. And every time he referred to something esoteric, he would quote from primary source material. And he would quote extensively, which at that time was extremely, I mean, aside from being really impressive, what I found totally relevant about this was that anthropologists, I'd been studying Joseph Campbell in high school, and when I got to college, I found that a lot of anthropologists criticized him for committing the cardinal sin of cultural anthropology, which is to apply the values of one culture to the morality and, you know, values of another culture out of context. And Joseph Campbell, in effect, does that constantly at a very high level and without any apology at all. And so I thought, well, you know, maybe he's just a popularist of anthropological concepts. Suddenly I realized he was a stunningly learned scholar. And I realized that at that level of scholarship, you have the right to break whatever rules that your profession may have. I mean, there are few people in the world today who even aspire to that kind of scholarship. And I was lucky to study with another scholar named Jakob Amstutz, who was an Austrian scholar in the same general field of esoteric writing and stuff. And he was the same. He quoted the Sanskrit in Sanskrit when he was talking about Sanskrit. He didn't read stuff that other people, read their translations to see how it worked, but he wasn't, you know, satisfied unless he translated it himself. And so I realized that, you know, Joseph Campbell is somehow has absorbed these values into his individual personality. But he's absorbed them from a very, very deep level of exposure and understanding to them, still admittedly as a foreigner, you know, from another culture. And so when a person like that says something about how things work, you really have to sit up and listen. Mm-hmm. Even if you want to question whether he's enlightened or not, that's another issue entirely. But he was a tremendously inspiring person because he didn't wield his knowledge. He was just absorbed in it and fascinated by it and had more of it than most people have of anything.
Yeah, and the motivation too. He actually talked in the same introduction to this book, he talked about this in a general sense, not just applying to himself, but it is true, you know, when you read about him that this was his motivation. He said human beings, unlike animals, have the ability to maintain childlike inquisitiveness and curiosity and playfulness into adulthood. Mm-hmm. Not all of them do, but he said that's where all of the great discoveries and all of the great knowledge has come from mm-hmm. people who had the capacity to just innocently go, what's this about? And just like go to the source and research it. And Einstein would talk that way too, you know, right. about the value of that approach. Richard Feynman does that. And Joseph Campbell I remember reading the story about when he was becoming a serious academician, and he was on just a regular, ordinary track of pursuit of knowledge. He was in Paris in a little park one day next to the oldest church in Paris and eating some lunch or something, and it was in that park that he had this kind of epiphany that gave rise to the direction that, mm-hmm. you know, this holistic direction that he wound up going in. And it was a very sudden thing where he just like dropped everything and just like went for it.
Yeah.
Which is also something that takes not being gripped by solid,
yeah.
objective,
yeah.
you know, you have to do it this way and following the rules. You can yeah. you could only be a Joseph Campbell if you were willing to go to the source of the rules instead of following them.
Yeah, and also to focus to the exclusion of a lot of other possible pursuits.
Yeah, right.
There was a series of books that I gobbled up enthusiastically in that same period called the Eranos Lectures, as published by Bollingen Books, and it's a series of annual meetings that this, I believe it was a Swiss woman sponsored, and she would invite all of these extreme esoteric scholars to her place for a week of discussion about things. And this was, you know, Otto Rank and Mircea Eliade and all of the leading thinkers in that field, Ernst Cassirer and stuff. And in those days, they had to have a secretary who transcribed everything and edited things and you know, put it all into shape for the book, and that was Joseph Campbell.
Huh.
So he was sitting amidst the greatest scholars of his youth,
yeah.
You know, parsing their discussions and mm. polishing it up and making it ready for publication. And I think that went on for 8 or 10 years. I don't remember now exactly how long. But you know, this thing about play, the first thing that came to mind was this simple statement from Maharishi about, kind of indirectly about play. One of his most important points was that, and he said literally, the one thing in life not to take seriously is taking things seriously.
Mm. Yeah, yeah. Well,
it should be play. It's yeah. supposed to be play. It's Leela Shakti if you
right,
go to,
exactly,
the,
yeah.
to the Vedanta.
Going back to that question, why did the Absolute manifest?
Yeah.
And the traditional answer is for the sake of play.
Yeah.
And how easy it is to forget that.
Yeah.
Even when we've heard it, you know?
Yeah, it's you can just, be told.
Well, the parts take on a life of their own, and then they don't want, because everything's constantly changing, the idea of that yeah. part giving way
yeah.
to change, that's where things go funny.
And the whole idea of the parts, you know, they're parts of our personalities and parts of our sort of inner history. And they direct us as if they were us. And that's the whole crux of the problem, is losing sight of the whole and becoming the parts, even on this sort of idiotic level of being a part of your own personality, which then becomes as if it were you.
Right, right.
And you're different people during the day, you know, mm-hmm. depending on which part is in the ascendant at that time. And if it's not the whole, then the whole thing is just ridiculous.
Well, and it's even strangely enough considered a virtue to try to define yourself, you know,
yeah.
to find some boundary for your identity and all of that. And I know of people, I have two very good friends who are, you know, my age or a little bit younger, who literally have said that they have never played. That even as children, they were just like serious little beings who were like watching about how are you supposed to do this and what am I supposed to do next and all of that. And as adults, I suppose probably there are aspects to them that are playful that they don't call playful. because I would think anybody would have to have a little bit of that, but in their own evaluation of themselves, it's almost as if play and that concept is dangerous somehow. They're, you know, sort of afraid of what might happen if they went there.
Well, and they may have been taught, well, they may have been taught that it was dangerous and stay away from that. But there's also very serious little adults. I mean, I was I like to play, but I was also very serious and took everything serious and was almost afraid of making a mistake. And so as I got older, I gave myself more permission to play, actually. I went from being fairly mature to being someone who learned how to have fun to then integrating the two.
Fear of making a mistake is one of the most horrible things in life. It just stifles so much because you learn from making mistakes, and if you don't call it a mistake, everything's fine. But we have it's sort of like you haven't failed at something until you stop. And then you can say, okay, I'm not trying anymore and I didn't succeed, therefore I failed. But if you keep trying, you haven't failed yet. And mistakes are kind of the same thing. There's really, you did something, and did you do it stupidly? I mean, we tend to call it that a lot, but it isn't really stupidity. Usually you're giving it your best thinking every step of the way anyway, and maybe you're not focusing as much, and maybe if you'd been more alert, but doesn't that mean maybe if you'd gone to bed earlier, and maybe that's the real mistake, and then... But maybe it's because you've established this habit of staying up too late, and that's the real mistake. And it's all just an ongoing thing, and judging it doesn't seem to accomplish anything.
Right, and it's trying to match life up to some standard that someone has placed before you or you've placed before yourself. And I find in teaching art classes that that's the biggest obstacle people have. You know, they come into the art class and go, oh, I did this wrong, you know. And then they get all tied up in knots. And I have to remind them of how Picasso, for example, when he did that sculpture of the man holding the lamb, he did hundreds of drawings and then models and everything, and until he got it the way he wanted it. And it wasn't a waste of time to do that. Matisse used to just to draw like a few leaves, he would just do them over and over again, just innocently, okay, let's do it again, let's do it again, let's do it again. So that it's more exploration rather than trying to get it right. And then when they reach a point that they feel finished, an artist like that, it isn't that they've matched it up to some preconceived idea, it's that after all of this exploration, some indefinable quality is there in the piece, and
they're done.
It feels complete.
And the distinction between making a mistake and exploring is that simply the difference between being serious and being playful. If you're playful, you do 25 drawings, and each drawing is an experiment. If you're serious, you do the first of the 25 drawings, and it's not the end result, so you failed and you've made a mistake and you stop.
So really we're talking about play being the nature of being on, you know. And it's part of, and in the West, our culture, this Judeo-Christian culture, is all built around heaven and hell and
right
being cast
and
down
wrong,
into the fiery pit if you make a mistake, and there's guilt is thread all through it. So we've got such a strong work ethic going, this Northern European work ethic. So we're up against that when we're born, and I think that's what makes those serious little children, for one thing, that kind of stuff.
But
when we start exploring what successful artists do, is they play is the best description.
Taking things seriously is based on fear. Playing is based on anticipation.
Well, I think it's the nature of the human mind and the human being to play. And to explore.
Absolutely. Yeah, we learn how not to play.
Yeah.
We start out knowing how to play, then we learn how to suppress it.
Yeah, I mean, I grew up in a family that was very much in the Judeo-Christian tradition of, you know, these very strict rules you had to abide by to be good and, you know, avoid punishment. And I was not a serious little person. I was a person who had this vast imagination and wanted to just explore in it all the time. And my parents were constantly trying to tone me down by saying, you're living in a dream world, you know, like my mother used to say to me always, you're in for a rude awakening someday. That was her way of saying it. You know? It was a battle. And my way of dealing with it, thank heavens, it was not to give up my imaginative freedom, but to just hide it more from them, you know, like go off into the woods or go play with my friends and not behave that way in front of the people who were going to
give you the negative feedback.
Yeah, right. Yeah. And so I kind of had that, became a more of a solitary little person, and that was my way of survival. But the unfortunate thing about that means of survival is that even at this stage of my life, at the age of 63, it's hard for me to be brave being myself, you know, my playful, authentic self, around people who are critical and serious and judgmental and all that. So I still find myself running into my little cave of my house and being authentic instead of...
Yeah, we want to be liked and approved of and accepted and not judged, even by people we don't respect.
Right, but we're bringing that a lot of that baggage up from our childhood and from the culture that we grew up in.
Yeah,
and I think that the age we're living in is where these things are coming in. They're confronting one another, and we're having to work that out and integrate those two sides of things.
And there's more and more people I'm realizing our age who really are tired of bowing to that fear of being judged and all of that, and kind of coming out more in terms of just who they really are and what they...
I think we've been seeing some waves of this. Mm-hmm. I think this is always a play going on between the artists and the other types, the types that keep things running like a well-oiled machine. The artists have always been the goad, you know, to that, because they can't not live in that place. Mm. So it's culture will flourish, I think, when the things are in balance. Now I lost my train of thought.
Well, the whole process of art, you know, brings this issue into the foreground.
Yeah.
And so if you want to be creative, you have to confront both the fear of failure and the necessity of just having fun with it, because it's only when you let go of the seriousness that you can... I mean, to learn to draw well, you pretty much have to start by drawing badly. And, you know, anything you're doing works that way, but I think in the arts, where you're sort of deliberately doing these unnecessary things and creating these unnecessary challenges that society hasn't already completely set you up for, you're kind of asking for trouble and you're asking for risk. And so you get used to it earlier, you know, if that's the path you've chosen. And it doesn't have to apply only in what we call the arts. I mean, it applies anywhere that people are going to take chances and learn how to be creative and innovative in dealing with whatever it is they've chosen.
Yeah, like the people in Findhorn did with their gardening, you know, defied what everybody said was possible and produced a great garden. Or even ourselves, if we're cooking a meal in the kitchen. You know, I have friends who are afraid of cooking because, and if they do it, they have to follow a recipe book, you know, to the letter, because Otherwise, they might mess up and it won't turn out well. Whereas other people, like my son Dane, he started wanting to play with cooking when he was a young child and had absolutely no boundaries whatsoever. It's like, okay, let's try this with this, you know, completely things that you would never think would work together, and sometimes they didn't. But now he and his girlfriend, who kind of is on the same page, they will create the most marvelous meals with combinations of foods that you just, you know, they're not French food or Chinese food or Indian food or anything. They're just Dane food, you know, something that's invented and works.
Well, that's, you know, in a sense, what's happening, I think, with this radio show. You know, we have to approach it knowing that we don't know what we're going to be actually talking about. Mm. And if we were serious about it, we wouldn't do it. We'd be back home, you know, sitting at a table writing things down and then trying to convert that into a conversation. And after having done it a few times, we would quickly discover how unpleasant it is to listen to and we wouldn't do it anymore. But instead, you know, we start every show almost with a completely blank canvas, and we don't know where it's going to go. And the less we interfere, the more likely it is to go someplace that turns out to be interesting.
Because what it is, it's an exploration, basically. That's what we're doing, and I love it. This is one of my favorite things to do, recording these radio shows, because exactly that, we just take a little seed idea and then just see where it goes.
But each of us is bringing a fairly deep level of life experience to the table. See, there's an interesting balance here between knowledge and experience and playfulness. Yep. They sort of both have to be there. Yep. And when a very neat point you brought up is this idea of playing at dying, playing at, you know, in other words, playing at being serious.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that we have to take life serious, we supposedly, and the best way to do that is to play at taking it serious.
You've been listening to Icon Art Radio, a production of Iowa Contemporary Art, Fairfield.